You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. A mass shooting is defined as an incident where four or more people have been shot and killed, not including the shooters. The places where the most people have died in mass shootings are familiar: Columbine, Sandy Hook, Las Vegas, Orlando, Virginia Tech, and an Amish schoolhouse in Lancaster County. The shootings have been at schools, colleges, and universities, workplaces, and retail establishments. Protective measures have been taken at schools and workplaces. Often, the availability of guns or mental health are blamed. But what really is behind what truly is an American phenomenon? Our guests today have compiled a database and studied every mass shooting since 1966. They've compiled their findings in a new book, The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. Joining us today, Dr. Jillian Peterson, a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University, and Dr. James Densley, a professor of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University, part of the Minnesota state system. I want to welcome both of you to the program. Before we get into some of your findings, the definition of mass shooting creates some confusion. Now, you address this right at the front of your book. Dr. Peterson, I'll ask you this question. Why settle on four murdered?
Four or more people killed has kind of been the traditional definition, according to the FBI and other sources, for a long period of time. And four more people killed in a public place typically generates a lot of media attention, which is what we need to do our work and gather information. We also exclude crimes related to other felonies, so things like robberies gone bad, and we exclude cases where the victims are primarily family members.
Dr. Densley, that definition, I shouldn't say the definition itself, but there is some confusion about definitions. I saw one story that said there have been 450 mass shootings this year. Now, one is too many, but under your definition, how many have been there been this year?
So under our definition, which is a more sort of conservative, a little bit more of a narrow definition, we're looking at five this year. But if you have a broader look at mass shootings as just any time multiple people are shot, then you start to get up into those numbers of 400, 500. And I think the thing that's striking about both of those things is all the definitions are somewhat imperfect, but they give us a different phenomena each time. So the pathway to a mass shooting for somebody who is killing four more people in a public space looks a little bit different, perhaps, to a drive-by gang-related shooting in a city. And we sometimes have to be careful about, do we want to label all those cases as mass shootings because of the implications for that? But all that being said, whether it's five this year or whether it's 500 this year, that is a very unique American phenomena. You look across the rest of the world, particularly comparable nations, and there may be one a year, there may be zero in a given year. And that's really what's striking about this. And it's one of the reasons why we're motivated to try and change the conversation about mass shootings and see if we can prevent them.
Well, let's address what you just brought up. And I called it an American phenomenon. What is it about the United States that we have so many mass shootings?
Well, I'd say there's two or three things going on here. Number one, people automatically will go to the prevalence of firearms in the country. And I'll say that compared to other nations, the United States has easier access to firearms and it has more firearms. And there's definitely some truth to that, but there's also other countries across the world where access to firearms is there too. You look at somewhere like Switzerland, for example, and they don't have as many mass shootings. So then you start to take another step back and say, well, what else is different about the United States? And we have a chapter in the book that kind of dives into the history of the country and some of its sort of cultural values and some of its norms. And one of the things that is striking is the lack of a social safety net in the United States versus other comparable nations. That means that when you've got frustrations, when you're angry, when you feel like life's not working out for you, you might feel like you want to take it out on others and take revenge. Whereas in other countries, there might be other avenues to get the help and support you need. So you think about universal healthcare and other factors like that as a good example. And the pandemic has really exposed, I think, a lot of those kind of challenges within American society.
Dr. Peterson, let's go back to the Violence Project itself. What is the Violence Project?
Yeah, the Violence Project, it's now a nonprofit organization. It started out as just kind of a number of students and James and I deciding we wanted to take on figuring out this pathway to violence for public mass shooters. There was all this sort of conversation in the media and policy debates, but we couldn't find any real information on who these individuals were and how they were getting to this point. So we started building this database of 180 mass shooters coded on nearly 200 pieces of life history information with a grant from the U.S. Department of Justice. And we also conducted interviews. So we interviewed five perpetrators who committed a mass shooting who are incarcerated. We interviewed their parents and their childhood teachers and their old best friends. We interviewed victims and first responders. And the goal was really to understand this pathway to violence for this particular phenomenon so we can start cutting it off and actually preventing shootings from happening.
You say right at the very beginning of the book that your research is driven by one thing, and that is how to stop mass shootings. When you have that, and I can say that when you're driven by one thing, that is a goal. How does that goal translate? I mean, once we get into this conversation, we'll see that this is not just a simple solution, that you offer multiple suggestions, but how do you achieve that goal?
I think for a long time, we've been responding to shootings by doing things like adding in bulletproof doors and training ourselves and our children to run, hide, and fight, and thinking about armed officers at the doors. And that's because we didn't understand where these individuals were coming from, where this phenomenon was coming from. So the best thing that we could do is try to minimize casualties and protect ourselves. What we've discovered is there is this pattern in these individuals' lives. And if we can look at the period of time right before the actual crime, how people are getting weapons, who people are leaking their plans to, then we start to develop a real plan for true prevention. And so that was always in the back of our minds. What sort of stories, what consistent findings can we see in these life histories that can help us create more effective policy?
Now, I want to get into some of your findings, and eventually we will get to the suggestions that you have on ways to stop mass shootings. But you have a database, as we said, for every mass shooting since 1966. You found that there were four commonalities amongst the shooters. What are those commonalities, Dr. Densley?
So the first thing that we saw in the life histories of these shooters was early childhood trauma. And in some ways, that feels intuitive because it lays a foundation for perhaps what comes later. Now, a lot of people experience trauma early in life. It doesn't mean that they're going to become a mass shooter. But what we did see is really terrible stories of abuse and neglect in the lives of these individuals. So that's the first piece. The second is they all reach an identifiable crisis point in their lives. It's essentially the straw that breaks the camel's back, and it usually festers as some sort of grievance where they feel like there's somebody out there to blame for what is happening in their lives, whether it's a loss of a job or the loss of a relationship. But the really striking thing about that crisis point, and this is perhaps the most important piece, is it's often a suicidal crisis. And so we then start to think of mass shootings as being someone's final act. And that really changes how you go about preventing mass shootings when you think about it from a deterrence or a prevention standpoint. The third factor is mass shooters study other mass shooters. And there is a cultural script for this type of violence within American society. We've seen it in the news media. We've seen it on television. We see it on social media. And when people are looking for understanding in their lives, models of behavior. They go searching for them. And they don't have to look very far, unfortunately, because there's been so many mass shootings in the past. So they study other mass shooters. That kind of radicalizes them into this type of violence. And then the final thing is opportunity. So you need to have access to the people and places where these shootings are going to occur. And of course, you need access to firearms in order to perpetrate a mass shooting. So those are the four steps: childhood trauma, a crisis point, often a suicidal crisis, this kind of cultural script for the violence, and then finally, opportunity.
I notice you didn't mention mental illness. We've talked about that a little bit. We mentioned it a little bit earlier in our conversation that often after these mass shootings, as you said, there is a script for the mass shooter, as well as how the media handles it, how the public handles it, how government handles it. And one of the two things we hear most often is that this person was going through a mental illness crisis or was mentally ill. And the other blame point is guns. But I noticed, Dr. Gentile, you didn't mention mental illness.
Yeah, I didn't mention mental illness. That's because we can say that anybody who perpetrates a mass shooting is obviously not living their most full life, and they're not perhaps very well. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're ill, mentally ill. We actually ran the numbers on this. One of the hardest things to sort of disentangle when you think about mental illness is, to what extent is mental illness truly driving someone's behavior and truly driving what they do, like a mass shooting, for instance? So you may even have a diagnosable mental illness, but that doesn't mean that everything you do every day, 24/7, is driven by that mental illness. So the easiest way to disentangle this was to look at something like psychosis. So if you are experiencing delusions and hallucinations that may be driving you toward violence, what we found in our research is that only in about 10% of the mass shooters in our database was psychosis the true driving motivation for the violence that followed. In all other cases, we were seeing lots of other things that were going on in people's lives as well. And I think there's two important takeaways from this. Number one is, we don't want to stigmatize mental illness and make it sound like everybody who perpetrates a mass shooting has a mental illness, because there's so many people in the world living with mental illness. There's so many different types of mental illnesses that they get conflated. And then I think the other piece is that this is a complicated picture. And so it's not just about that diagnosable illness. It's also about poverty. It's also about frustrations at work. It's also about the argument that you had with your girlfriend. There's lots of other things that are going on in people's lives that can be compelling them toward violence. And it's not easy just to put it in one box and then sort of explain it away with mental illness.
Dr. Peterson, I'll address this to you. Dr. Densley just talked about mental illness as part of this. But you, the two of you have broken this down even further with different types of mass shooters. School shooters, for example, have their own characteristics or own commonalities. Those who are, conducted a mass shooting at a college or university had theirs. Workplace shooters had theirs. It seems as though school shooters, let's talk about school shooters first. Those are the ones that seem to get the most publicity. But let's talk about school shooters. What are some of the commonalities, if you will, or characteristics of school shooters?
Sure. Perpetrators of school shootings tend to be 15 to 16 years old white males who are current students of the school, which is really important when we're thinking about prevention. They are typically young men who are depressed, who are actively suicidal, and who are studying other perpetrators of mass shootings, namely the Columbine case.
What about college and university shooters? It does seem as though most of those perpetrators, or more of those perpetrators, maybe I should say, that mental illness is part of that.
And that's That's true. So college and university shooters tend to be, again, students of that college or university, which tends to be a large public university. They tend to be non-white. They are more likely to experience psychosis or serious mental illness. And they're also more likely to leave behind what we call a legacy token, a manifesto, something that people will read and look at after they commit their horrible crime that will kind of live on.
Workplace shooters, what about them?
Yeah, workplace shooters are a little bit different. Their crimes tend to be a little bit less planned. Typically, the triggering event is either being fired or suspended or reprimanded. Firing is most common. They're about 50% white, 50% black. They tend to be older, like in their 40s, and they tend to use a handgun that they legally own.
I know I'm going to be jumping around on you with this, but Dr. Densley, when you talked about those four characteristics, you say exposed to violence or abuse. Now, you're not just talking, and the word exposed is what I'm picking out here. When you're talking about exposed to violence, you're not just talking about video games or movies. What do you mean when you're talking about exposed to violence?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think one of the big myths about mass shootings is that it is violent video games that is to blame for the whole phenomenon. I've often said if that were true, then you'd have the most amount of mass shootings in Japan, because they play plenty of video games there in that part of the world. So when we mean exposure to violence, it's often an intimate exposure to violence. So it is that the perpetrators of mass shootings perhaps are themselves victims of violence earlier in their life. That could be domestic violence. It could be sexual violence. It could be bullying later in life as well. So we see them as being as having that victimization experience early in life. The other exposure as well, when I said it's very intimate, is that they are witnesses to violence, often in the home. So we see domestic violence in the home is quite common. And we've even had cases where there's been parental suicide that the eventual perpetrators of mass shooters have been exposed to as children. And I think the point with this is, again, there are millions of people across the world who get exposed to violence, particularly domestic violence, who never go on to perpetrate a mass shooting. But what we see in the lives of these individuals is they are exposed to that type of violence, but then they don't get the support and the care and the help that they need. And it sort of builds over time with a number of other factors that then result in the outcome that we see later on.
Dr. Peterson, along those lines, the two of you in the book point out that relationships are important, that most often, I mean, and this almost sounds too simple when we say they need someone to talk to, but that may be too simple of an explanation. But having some type of support, whether it's a mentor, whether it's a teacher to talk to, whether it is another relative to talk to, that these mass shooters tend to not have that kind of support or those kind of relationships.
Yeah, and this was the piece that was surprising and gave me actually a lot of hope, is that when we would talk to perpetrators who were in prison, incarcerated the rest of their lives, and we would say, is there anything or anyone that could have stopped you? Every single time they said yes. And so I think we can get, you know, caught up in the big policy conversations that we need to have around guns and around access to mental health care and around trauma screening. But also, when someone is at the brink and they are depressed and they're suicidal and they're angry and they've been radicalized and they're collecting weapons, sometimes someone just stepping in, carving out the space to connect with them and give them a tiny piece of hope can actually get them through that crisis moment that they're in. And we talked to people that we call kind of almost perpetrators who were planning a shooting, one that even went to the school with the gun in his backpack and changed his mind because of that human connection.
Something you just touched on as well is that most shooters give signals ahead of time or tell someone ahead of time that this is something that they're planning or thinking about, Dr. Densley.
Yeah, that's right. The sort of technical term for it, and it's not that technical, is they call it leakage, in as much that the information is spilling out of the individual. And this is a very common thing that we see in the histories of the mass shooters. And one of the key takeaways, I think, and we write about this a lot in the book, is that we need to be attuned to what those warning signs are. And sometimes I think we get caught up in this idea that we're looking for threatening behaviors, but it's not necessarily always a threatening behavior that is indicative of actually the underlying struggle that that person is experiencing. So what it really is just a case of us looking out for one another. It's recognizing when someone's struggling, when they're in crisis, and then getting them connected to what they need. The big takeaway for us in the research was there are barriers to getting people connected. So one of them is that we just don't take the warning signs at face value, that we don't believe them, or we don't want to be a snitch, or we don't want to get people in trouble. I think part of the reason for that is because we have really defaulted to law enforcement as being the first and only line of defense on this issue. And people are thinking, well, I don't really want to call the police on my own child or on my best friend, but I know they need help. So what do I do? So we've got to make it a lot easier to report, but we've also got to make it so that the response is not always punitive. Because if we're just going to exclude our way or discipline our way or arrest our way out of this problem, that's not going to work. So we need those viable alternatives, and we need everybody looking out for one another, knowing those signs, so that you can reach in and say, something's not right here. Let me talk to you. Let me see what's going on in your life. But we're not going to punish you for that because you've not done anything yet.
So what do you do if you don't call the police? Because you're right, we've been conditioned that if you suspect that a classmate, a coworker is planning something like that, maybe they've written about it, maybe they've gone online, you know, that they are in a crisis, what do you do?
So we've looked at go ahead.
We in the book, we highlight some sort of innovative strategies that people are using. And we really support this idea of building crisis response teams in schools and in workplaces, in churches, in community centers, so that people know, here's where I can report. Anonymous reporting systems are great. They increase reporting. Strong relationships where people trust each other also increase reporting. A place where that information is gathered, and then people can think about what the right response is. So in a school setting, if someone posts something threatening online and that gets reported, the first response is going to be to talk to that student, to try to figure out what's going on in their lives, to see what they need. It's not necessarily to go arrest them, but it's maybe to connect them with school-based mental health services or with community resources. So I think the more that our institutions can start building those systems for reporting concerning behavior and responding with care and compassion, the better that will be in terms of preventing mass shootings and also preventing all sorts of other things like self-harm, suicide, other forms of violence.
Dr. Peterson, you write in the book, and I think you mentioned this a little bit earlier, that the response to mass shootings, especially in schools, has been metal detectors, bulletproof glass, lockdown drills, that kind of thing. I don't know whether you actually say this in the book, but the sense I get in the book is those things don't work.
Yeah, and they don't work. We haven't seen a decrease in school shootings since we started implementing all of this 20 years ago. We've only seen an increase. And we think the reason they don't work is because school shooters are insiders. They are students of that school. These aren't scary outsiders coming in that nobody's seen before. These are students who are going through those metal detectors every day, who are running through those same lockdown drills with everybody else and learning the school's procedures. These are students moving in and out of that building. They know exactly where the school resource officer is. They know that building. And so beefing up our security to keep bad guys out doesn't work if the perpetrator is inside the school.
Mm. Social proof, Dr. Densley, what is social proof?
So social proof is actually a psychological concept. There's a lot of literature out there about it. We've sort of adapted it and applied it in this context because it refers to the idea of, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, that we're always looking for models of behavior, particularly at times of uncertainty. And when you are somebody who is depressed, is struggling in life, trying to figure out where you fit in, you're looking for how have other people coped with that same problem. And unfortunately, with the rise of the internet, what we see is that these sort of young people, particularly young people, school shooters, who are thinking about a mass shooting, looking online and thinking, well, these other school shooters have done this. Maybe that's the solution for me too. So the social proof is this idea that there is a kind of blueprint for mass violence, and that people see themselves in the lives of the other mass shooters. They identify with them because they look like and sound like and are experiencing the same things as they are. And that then can create this sort of incentive structure to think about, perhaps I want to follow in their footsteps. And that's where you get a little bit of this sort of contagion element with mass shootings, which is that people often are referencing other mass shootings in their own mass shootings. And that creates this sort of a social phenomena where the cycle continues.
Dr. Peterson, you mentioned earlier Columbine is kind of the standard for many school shooters. Media's role. There is a lot of information online, but the media has a pattern itself of how it covers these events. There are some school shooters that are looking for fame, and they know from past shootings that they'll become famous. What about the media's role here and responsibility?
That's a really important piece of this, is that mass shootings are meant to show the world this individual's grievance. They tend to be suicides, but they're these very public suicides where they take lots of people with them, and their goal is to make headlines, to make their manifesto go viral, or to make their YouTube videos go viral. We have perpetrators who even check Facebook in the middle of the shooting to make sure people are talking about it. So when we give them that coverage, and when we put their faces on the front page of magazines, and when we all read their manifestos live on the evening news, that's exactly what's motivating future shootings. So I think the media's role in making sure that we are covering the shooting, but paying attention to the victims, paying attention to the heroes, not giving the perpetrators the attention and the fame and the notoriety that they are looking for, that is going to help stop the cycle.
You write about shooters having an opportunity, and that's where you address the availability of guns. Dr. Densley, how do most mass shooters obtain their firearms?
So the majority actually are getting their firearms legally. And this is quite striking in as much that there are a number of loopholes in the existing system where we've seen a system failure to conduct the appropriate background checks or to do the due diligence, which may have prevented this. Also, we often see that people are purchasing firearms really close to the time in which they're going to be perpetrating the shooting. They're kind of amassing an arsenal for this, which speaks to some of the points of intervention which are available to us. So for example, if somebody's in a state of crisis and that's the moment when they're purchasing a firearm, that's where something like a red flag law, it's also known as an extreme risk protection order, could be come in play. One other thing I want to flag for you, which is actually really important, is that for school shooters, because they're younger, they tend to get their firearms by stealing them or borrowing them from friends and family members. So safe storage of firearms is something that we all can do. And you don't need an act of Congress to do that, but that could prevent violence. And not only does that prevent potentially a mass shooting, but also an accidental shooting or a suicide. And that's one of the things we try and do in the book, is highlight there are things we can do as individuals to prevent this. That's one of them, safe storage. There's things we need to do as institutions, like Jill talked about earlier, building crisis teams in our schools and workplaces as an example. And then there are the bigger, heavier lifts that need to be done at that societal level, where perhaps we do need to close some of those loopholes, which would prevent people who are a danger to others from getting firearms so close to the shooting.
And I just want to list what, in relationship to guns, you suggest universal background checks, red flag laws, permit to purchase bans that in some states where, you know, you can get a gun right off the bat, magazine limits, wait periods, and an assault rifle ban. We only have a few minutes left. The last chapter of the book is entitled Hope, Solutions or Ways to Stop Mass Shootings. Dr. Peterson, I have to say, I counted 34 suggestions, ranging from crisis intervention to gun laws. Most people want simple solutions. How can we do that? How can we stop these mass shootings when you have 34 different suggestions?
Yeah, if only there was just one that we could just do and that would fix it. But these are complicated problems that require complicated solutions from a lot of different angles. And no one solution is going to fix this. But as you start piling solutions on top of each other, that's when you really get somewhere. And so we wanted to give, as you said, 34 different possible solutions, because that gives all of us things we can do as individuals, things that we can do in our workplaces and schools and places of worship, things that we can ask our representatives to do. It gives us this sort of wide variety of things that says this is a complicated problem and the roots of violence and that pathway to violence is long. But what's incredibly hopeful about that is you can build off ramps at all these different spots along that pathway to violence. There are things we can do, tangible things that we can do that we don't just have to sit back and feel helpless. And so we wanted to really dig in on that complex nature of this problem and the complex nature of the solutions that we need.
Dr. Jillian Peterson, Dr. James Densley, authors of the book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. Excellent book. Relies on science for something that obviously is a huge problem here in the United States. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks for having
us. Thanks so much.